Next week, we're going to begin a new series in the book of Exodus, which I will be involved in for a long time. That's quite a large book that we're going to be in. Before we get there, though, I had this message that I've been kind of mulling over in my mind for many months now. It's part of a three-part series, and this week I'll have Debbie work on this with in the office, to trying to put these three together, and maybe the guys can even package these up as a series. Two times last fall, 2009, last fall, I preached twice on the crisis that the United States was in regarding the subject of economics. This would be the third, and this would complete that series. So they kind of fit together if you want to review those and try to understand more completely what I'm saying. I think it's important for me not only to be teaching you the scripture, but also every once in a while to take a look at the times that we live in and consider those moments, which are pregnant moments in my view for how we're going to continue on the faith and what we need to do to be the people of God. So we're going to look today at this topic. I want to begin with this story. It was a warm day. It seemed like the air conditioners never ceased to quit running. There were two men that were in a large boardroom in Washington, D.C. They were by themselves. One was leaning on his arms, looking out the window and gazing at the things that were happening out in the courtyard, while the other was sitting at the head of a large corporate table, boardroom. And the one said to the other, "We can't keep doing this. We can't keep putting our finger in the dike. We're going to have to do something more than that." The other responded by saying, "You're talking about direct infusion." He said, "Yeah, I am." He said, "I don't see any other way around it myself." He said, "I'll have my staffers make the phone calls. We'll set up the meeting." "How soon?" "It's got to be Friday. It can't be later than Friday." They ended that meeting, and a phone call was made to Nancy Pelosi, who's Speaker of the House. As you know, things changed late last summer and into the fall regarding the economics of our country, and I want to give you a rundown of that whole process that happened, and then we're going to look at how that relates to our lives and some of the comments that Jesus stated at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Dennis, would you put up the first frame, please? There are two poles that people that are a part of our government and people that are in the upper echelons of the economic system of our country wrestle with. On the one side, there is the subject of moral hazard, and on the other, systematic risk. Moral hazard poses the question, if someone like a government or an insurance agency continues to back up the misdealings of a particular company, then what incentive does the company have in the future for not making the same mistakes? Moral hazard says that if you keep doing that, you create an environment where you can continue the same kinds of behavior into the future. Consequently, it may be better that a company fail for its misdoings in regards to how it administrated itself. On the other side of that, of the teeter-totter that you see there, is systematic risk. Systematic risk concerns the idea that an institution may, of its own doing, fail, but its failure may be compounded because of the way it is interconnected with other financial institutions. Consequently, if it goes down, it may take other companies that had nothing to do with the wrongdoing that was created here in this company with them. The two are there, and that is a theme that plays out in what I'm going to call the anatomy of a tremor. Next frame, Dennis. Now, I got to give my hat off to my secretary, Debbie, here, because I draw this stuff up on a legal pad, and then she's got to figure it out and then put it onto PowerPoint somehow. So thanks to Debbie here. The news began with a rumor on a Monday concerning Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns was one of the 10 largest investment banks in the United States, although it was the smallest of the 10. On a Monday, rumors were beginning to fly that Bear Stearns was not as solvent as people might have thought. And by the time Wednesday had taken place, $17 billion in cash had already been exhausted as investors were pulling their money from Bear Stearns. By that time, phone calls were being made to try to make a deal where Bear Stearns would be purchased by another company and there were no suitors. Consequently, a man by the name of Tim Geithner, who happens to be now the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, formerly he worked for the Federal Reserve, was seated in New York City. He was instructed to go there, his people to go there and take a look at Bear. When they got there, a phone call was made around 3 o'clock in the morning to his boss, one of the two men in my first part of my story, a man by the name of Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve. What they found was that Bear was loaded to the gills with toxic assets, subprime mortgages, and something far worse than that, a little-known investment vehicle known as credit default swaps. And what basically they were insurance contracts that the bonds, they had taken together these subprime mortgages, packaged them in a bond, sold them to investors, and then for an additional fee, sold an insurance policy against them that if they ever failed, Bear would pay. As long as the person paid the premium, Bear made money. The person had the peace of mind to know that if anything ever happened, their investment was covered. Well, Bear was failing, and its investments in these subprime mortgages were failing at a quick rate. Consequently, what happens is that Bear begins to fold and implode. The Federal Reserve comes in, and you'll see there the FR. This would be Federal Reserve. $30 billion is offered to J.P. Morgan Chase to buy up what's left of Bear. Bear stock started at $72. By the time we got to that Wednesday, it was $30. We were up to Friday, it was sinking below that. On Monday morning, a phone call was made. Well, Monday morning, the transaction took place. But on Sunday afternoon, a phone call was made from the T there. You'll see that. That's the Treasury. And this would be a man by the name of Henry Paulson. Hank Paulson, also the man in my beginning of my story, made a phone call to the chairman of the board of J.P. Morgan Chase and said, what was the rate going to be for the buy for Bear Stearns? J.P. Morgan was offering $4 a share. Paulson said, no, you ought to make it $2 a share. He said, we want them to get the idea that they're not going to be subsidized for the wrongdoing that they did. At this point, moral hazard is driving the decision. And so I wanted it to be so painful for the investors of Bear that it's almost like they went out of business. And so consequently, unfortunately, for 30% of the owners of Bear stock were Bear employees, where their retirement was wrapped up in that. They ended up having the high priestly price of $2 a share for their stock. By Monday morning, Bear Stearns was gone. In less than a week, one of the largest companies in the United States was completely gone. The next thing was a contagion that began to happen. Two of the largest companies on the planet began to have trouble as well. As these subprime mortgages began to default in large numbers, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two companies that were begun after World War II with money from the government, but interestingly enough, were still publicly traded. Now, what everybody needs to understand here is every institutional investor in the United States owns Freddie and Fannie Mae stock, or better stated, Freddie and Fannie Mae debt. All pension funds, mutual funds that invest in North America, $5 trillion. And in less than 4 days, these two companies lost 50% of their stock value. At that point, If they would have failed, that would have been the very definition of systemic risk, the other side of the teeter-totter. At that point, the Federal Reserve and also Ben Bernanke come in, and they literally seize the companies. They fired the board of directors, they seized the company, they infused it with all kinds of capital and money to stiffen it up, and they thought maybe that would do it. They had taken care of Bear, they had taken care of Freddie and Fannie. But it wasn't long after that that the contagion continued to go, and before you know it, another investment bank on Wall Street is in trouble. This time, much larger than Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. Bigger company, more connected to Wall Street, same problem. Subprime mortgages and credit default swaps. At this point, the Federal Reserve and also the Treasury are having bailout fatigue. They're saying to themselves, all right, somebody's got to go down. We can't keep doing this. We can't keep putting our finger in the dike. Somebody's going to have to go down. And so the decision was made, we're going to let Lehman go. And conversations went back and forth all summer between the CEO of Lehman and also Hank Paulson, who formerly was the leader of the Treasury, formerly the CEO of Goldman Sachs. He is a Republican, he has a deregulatory mindset, and he's telling the CEO of Lehman Brothers, a man by the name of Dick Folt, sell the company, come up with a deal. You're going to have to do this on your own. For whatever reason, that didn't happen. By the time we got to Monday morning, Lehman was going to go under. Now, what the Federal Reserve did at this point, next frame, and the Treasury, they knew that this was going to be devastating news if Lehman Brothers collapsed. So then what was decided was, we've got to have something in place that we don't have this domino effect that starts to happen with these banks. And they knew the next one that was in line that was going to go down was going to be Merrill Lynch. So what they had arranged was, they picked the one bank that still had a shard of solvency, which was Bank of America, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, not on Wall Street. And they arranged for Bank of America to purchase Merrill Lynch. And they wanted that news to hit the market the exact same moment that the news happened that Lehman was going to go out of business. And they felt that if that came in at that point, that would calm the jitters of the market. It didn't. As soon as the news happened that Lehman went under, the stock market careened down, and what's more than that, all of a sudden, banks stopped lending to banks, and credit begins to stop. By September 18th, that's what happens. The decision to let Lehman go, in some way, some would look at it was, it was a decision that could have blown up the world. Lehman goes under, credit begins to stop, and then the full-blown ramifications of the recession are in full bloom. At this point, this brings us to this conversation that happened earlier that was in my story. Bernanke and Paulson are looking at this and saying, we can't keep doing this one investment at a time. We're running out of money. We don't have the capacity to get this in place so that we don't have this domino effect where they all begin to go under. And so they went to Congress. They went to a meeting, and they sat down with all the leaders of the Congress and basically outlined on a Friday afternoon, here is the situation. Chris Dodd, a Democrat, recounted it. He said, here is Ben Bernanke. He is here's a guy that had taught himself calculus in high school. He was summa cum laude at Harvard. He had a PhD from MIT. He's sitting there in a room with no superlatives, no excessive adjectives, and basically saying to the Congress, unless you act, the economy of the United States will melt down on Monday morning along with the world. Dodd said there was a moment that the oxygen was sucked out of the room, and everyone was just fixed for about what seemed to be hours, I'm sure it was seconds. And so what happens is that they agree that they're going to go to Congress and basically give them a blank check of $700 billion to have assets ready to beef up these troubled banks. And that's what happens. But not long after that, the contagion then gets to outside of the banking area to an insurance company called AIG. AIG is the largest insurance company in the world, based in New York City. Again, its failure would be the definition of systemic risk. If it goes down, others are affected. What had happened was AIG had offered credit default slips to Lehman to back up Lehman in regards to the investments that it had done on the presupposition that Lehman would never go bankrupt. Lehman was bankrupt. And AIG is sitting there saying, we have all this money, what are we going to do? They didn't have the resources to make any kind of a help. So what happens is then there is a bailout of AIG, of an insurance company. Unprecedented kinds of things that are happening. But the end of this then was, shortly after that, a meeting is held, a summons goes out to every CEO of the largest banks in the United States, 10 to 12 of them. You know, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America on one side, Wells Fargo on the other. All CEOs come to an appointment that is had with the Treasury. And the Treasury says, I want you to be here a certain time. They all came, they sat down, and basically they got right to it. And the Treasury said, this is Hank Paulson, he said, here's what we want to do. Essentially, we want to take a stake in every one of the banks. We're going to take a stake in them. We're going to send you X amount of dollars over the next 2 weeks, and we are going to be able to have say in what happens in your bank. Now, some of them are saying, we don't want your money. Treasury says, you're taking the money. Now, the reason for this is they knew that when they came in and offered all of the help to Bear, the stock continued to go down, so that people knew that the bank was in trouble. If they had spread out the money across the board of all of them equally, then people wouldn't get the idea that certain banks were in trouble more than others. That was the idea. So they take a stake in those banks, and they ask them to sign a document that says that they would comply with this. And every single one of them, that afternoon, before they left Washington, D.C., signed the document. The nationalization of banks in the United States was underway. Now, next frame. What happens in this tremor is that systemic risk then trumps moral hazard. The idea being that if we keep letting these things fail, we are probably looking into a hole where we don't know where the bottom of it is. I want you to think about this for the moment. Here you have Hank Paulson, who is a Republican, appointed by George W. Bush, a Republican, a deregulatory kind of guy who becomes the most invasive Treasury Secretary that we've had since the Great Depression. For him to make that move in his life, whether you want to consider it right or wrong, he had to have been really scared at what he saw. No one knew where this was going to go. Now, my point on this is a tremor. This isn't the big one. And my remarks this morning are for you to evaluate your own life in regards to a big one that I think is coming. Consider the evidence. Next frame. What you've got here is a picture, this is half of it, of the federal budget. You'll see here it goes from the top, you've got the Office of the President. Third from the bottom, you see something familiar to you like NASA. You have other agencies behind that. The last one on that page is the Department of Homeland Security. That was created after 9/11. The red indicates how many billions of dollars are allocated in our budget each year to fund those kinds of things. Next frame. This is continuing that same budget, which begins with the Department of Energy. You see Veterans Affairs there around the middle, Department of Agriculture, and then you get to the three bottom ones, the Department of Defense, and then Health and Human Services. Health and Human Services would include Medicare and Medicaid. And then you have the bottom of the bottom is the Treasury debt and debits that add up for the federal government. So that last red mark is telling you how many billions of dollars are spent on interest on the national debt out of the budget each year. In addition, keep in mind this, that the Iraq war is now funded offline. So all of the costs for that war over the last 5 years are not even represented in this budget. Now, regarding President Obama, you can love him or you can hate him. I'm not making a case either way for him. But one thing I will say this, that he's right about. The fastest thing that's going to sink the ship in the United States is the growing cost of Medicare and Medicaid. How to deal with that, I don't know. I'm not sure. But when you look at these numbers, you'll see what's going on here. Under Health and Human Services, that is going to continue to grow as the population of the United States continues to age. Next frame. What you're looking at here is the revenue, is the red line that comes in. And if you look over to the right, the dark gray is Medicare and Medicaid. Below that is Social Security. Everything that's above the red line are all the other government programs that are there. Everything else that you just looked at in those charts. And as you move forward in these years, by the time you get to 2055, the amount of money that's being taken for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid almost takes everything else that's presently in the budget. That's what everybody is thinking about. All the pensions for employees, defense, whatever that costs, the Department of Energy, NASA, agriculture, all those other programs are above the red line, and you can see there's no money for it at all. Now, this is not a Republican or a Democratic problem, and I want to show you this in the next frame. This, I think, proves this more than anything. What you see there, the red lines are the deficits by year. In other words, the government is spending this much, but only bringing in this much. And each year there's a deficit, and that's what gets lumped on to the national debt, which increases the amount of money that the budget has to come up with to pay the interest. Not paying it down, just the interest. Now, interestingly enough, as the economy was booming, there were also some agreements that were made by President Clinton and Congress during the last term of his term of office. And the green lines, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, were the fruit of that. What the agreement was called PAYGO, pay as you go. In other words, they had come to terms and said, we're going to only pay for something if we have the money for it. And as a result of a very good economy and getting some good things in place regarding fiscal responsibility, there were surpluses. And from that point on, President Bush takes office in the year 01. That's the first term, and they still have a surplus at that point. They were projecting surpluses as far as the eye could see. Now, I have great praise for President Bush regarding moral issues. He was great on marriage. He was very good on abortion. I think he did a super job regarding stem cell research. He kept the country safe. We can all give those things and laud him. But I will tell you this. He will go down in history as one of the worst presidents this country has ever had when it came to fiscal responsibility. He pulled things that no one ever thought of doing before. Number one, he allowed, with a Republican Congress, to allow PAYGO to lapse. When that happened, they could spend more than what was coming in. The other thing that he did that was unbelievable was that when he launched the Iraq War, whether you're for it or against it, in the history of the United States, when presidents go to war, they recognize that you have to pay for it. And when you get into those kinds of situations, you have to cut back on other things that you really wanted to do. George Bush didn't do that. He did something that no one else ever did. He cut taxes at the same time that he took the country to war. Never happened before. Lyndon Johnson didn't do it. Eisenhower didn't do it. It didn't happen under Roosevelt. No one ever did that before. But if that wasn't enough, he didn't do it just once. He did it twice. He refunded and cut taxes twice in a time where he took the country to war with the cost of a war which wasn't even on the budget line. Unbelievable. But if that wasn't enough, he came with the idea of a Republican brand, which was started under Ronald Reagan. Reagan comes to office, smaller government, cut taxes, restrain spending, he did that, and he cut taxes in the first year of his term. By the second year, the deficit is spiraling out of control. What most people forget, or even chose to forget, is that Ronald Reagan, in his second year, passed one of the largest tax increases in the history of the country. And he did that because he knew his tax cut was too great. So he increased taxes from his cut to bring that budget in line. I was still upset with him and the Republican Congress at the time because they still didn't produce a balanced budget in 8 years of his term and 4 years of his the one that succeeded him, which was George Bush's father. And in addition to that, if that wasn't enough, before George Bush left office, he passed Medicare Part B. Medicare Part B is the promise of the government for prescription coverage for seniors. And everybody's saying, well, we got to do something about seniors. They're paying these high costs of prescription. He passed it with no way to pay for it. Nothing. And once it's in place, it is a promise to the American people. This is a guarantee that we will now cover some portion of your prescription coverage. There wasn't one bill that came across his desk that he ever sent back. He will go down as the biggest spender, I think, that the Republican Party ever produced. It's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. The Democrats now are in power, and as you look at the chart that's on the screen, you'll see in 09, you see where we are. Now, in fairness, President Obama does come to office at one of the worst economic times in the history of the government. And so the emphasis today is, yes, we're in trouble, but if federal government doesn't step in to spend money and stimulate things, it could get worse. This is back to the debate that I gave you in the first message last fall of the debate that goes on between people who follow the thinking of John Maynard Keynes and the people who follow the thinking of Friedrich von Hayek. Von Hayek said that economies were like ocean waves. They come into the beach and they go out. Sometimes they come in with such force they can do damage. Other times they recede where we would like to have more water there. Keynes said, no, it's not like that. It's more like a machine in which technocrats need to adjust it. On the other hand, von Hayek said, the more you fuss with it, the more you can create problems down the road. That's part of the debate right now. Von Hayek is out. Keynes is in. Government is involved in just about every area of things, trying to adjust the economy just the right way so that we could get through this dip that we're in, trying to prevent it from becoming some colossal downfall. But as you look at this, what you see here is we're at $1.7 trillion in the debt, which makes the total at $13 trillion and increasing to more than $20 trillion by 2055. In addition to that, there's $53 trillion of unfunded liability for Social Security and Medicare in a country whose population is rapidly getting to that place. Economists who wrote on this 20 years ago saying that there's a coming tsunami are standing up and saying right now, it's here. This is it. It's the beginning of the waves that are just starting to come into the beach. Now, I wanted to share this with you about where we are because the big one is when the federal government's finances melt down. There is an office in Washington, D.C., within walking distance of the White House in an undisclosed building. Inside, men and women report there every day. They sit at computers, and these are the bond administrators. And at given times during the year, they put out federal-backed bonds, and people come from all over the world to buy those bonds. What they're doing is they're selling bonds based on the faith and credit of the United States government to people from whoever they are, and that money comes in to fund what is being spent above the amount of money that comes in from the government. Okay? Below this line are all taxes. But above this, there's spending going on that we don't have the money for. These bonds are sold to make up the difference. And what happens over time is this is continuing to rise. The big one will happen when all of a sudden the people who want those bonds don't show up. And when that happens, that will be the big one. And I believe if it is not in my lifetime, for those of you that are under the age of 30, it will be in your lifetime. And I do not believe that the government will solve this problem until they get to that point. What really needs to happen right now is for the president or someone from Congress to stand up and basically tell you this. The bottom line is, we are in real trouble. We have lived way beyond our means. And in order to get this thing back in line, we're going to have to cut your benefits. We're going to have to cut the amount of money that you receive for Social Security. We're going to have to cut your Medicare benefits. For those of you that are on Medicaid, we're going to have to reduce that. And we're going to have to raise taxes on all of you, not just people that earn above $250,000. Everyone's going to have to pay more taxes. Before you think about the problem being with the politicians, I honestly believe the problem really is with the people. Because honestly, how much do you think the people of the United States of America want to hear a message like that today? They don't. But that's the truth. And that's why it won't happen. They won't. They'll postage stamp it. They'll band-aid it. They'll put rubber bands around it. But they won't actually deal with it. And this will continue to get to that point. When is that going to be? I don't know. But it's coming. And when that happens, life in the United States will really change over a period of time. I don't know about bread lines and all those other kinds of things, but the things that we take for granted as life here is going to change. Now, part of my responsibility, I think, as a pastor is to prepare you for where we are in our times. And that's why I'm trying to bring this together at this point so you really think about this in regards to your own life. It's not a Republican issue. It's not so much a Democratic issue. The problem here is that God is out of the picture, and the more that God is out of any society, there is an ascendancy of government to fill the gap. And now the tendency is we want government to be there to help us through the cradle all the way to the grave. We want government to be there, and we're all a part of this. We not only want our Social Security and our Medicare and those kinds of things, but we want help on those loans for college, and we want help for this and municipality works that are going on down in the city of Owosso. I just took advantage of it. You guys all helped me pay for a new furnace in our home. Okay? I got a tax credit coming, which you're going to help pay for, $1,500 for me to put a new furnace in my home. And the argument will be, you know, it's more energy efficient. If more people did this, we'd use less energy. All of that sounds good, but at the end of the day, we don't have the money to pay for it. We all are affected by this. So given that, and my presupposition is they will not solve this problem. It won't happen because the American people are not going to stand for less tax, less benefits and more taxes, particularly when the biggest voting bloc in the United States are people that are in the 65 and above category, which is rising all the time. Do you think that they're going to vote to have their Medicare and their Social Security reduced? I doubt it. So, this is a time for us to reevaluate our foundations. Next frame. Jesus makes this statement at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which is found in Matthew chapter 7, in which he kind of brings together all of the instruction that he had, probably over a weekend of time, when he begins to give them this parable about the story of two houses. He says, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and slammed against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded upon the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." Next frame. What we've got here is the story of two houses. And for all intents and purposes, I'm going to assume that from the ground up, they all look the same. You know, maybe they were two-story homes. They had the same kind of decor. maybe it was English Tudor, maybe it was a modern home, but they looked the same. And when you entered them, they looked similar as well. But the big difference between the two, you couldn't see with the eye. One was built on something of substance, something that doesn't subject to change, and the other one was built on something that is subject to change and is very susceptible to the elements. The storms of life are life. Life is filled with ups and downs. There's market busts and market booms. There's market cycles. All that stuff happens all the time. And life has many twists to it. But it's when the pressure builds up in life, when those storms begin to hit your life, whether it's finances, whether it's a challenging, rebellious child, whether it's a health issue that comes along, where you begin to take a look at, what is your life really built on? Now, for Christians, we say it's built on Christ. It's easy for us who live in a country that has supplied the kinds of benefits and safety nets that are in place in the United States to know that there's something else that we fall back on. In reality, the Word of God is saying, for the Christian, you're learning there is nothing else but the Word of God that should guide and direct your life, that ultimately you're grounded on. And that if you're grounded on it, it means that you're not only hearing the Word. See, Jesus' words here, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them. It's not simply hearing. It's the hearing and the doing of it that indicates the foundation is solid. In a time such as this, just taking an account of just the financial end of it, if you're living beyond your means, you're vulnerable. You're extremely vulnerable at this time. Now, I don't have a problem with mortgages. I mean, mortgage is one of the greatest things that ever happened. Instituted largely after World War II, many Americans have been able to buy their homes, eventually live in them, pay for them, move on in life. But you've got to be careful about mortgages. For those of you that are at that stage, be careful your eyes don't get gaga over some house that's this big, which means you have to have a mortgage that lasts that much longer in order to pay the thing off. Be careful about that. Those of you that are getting ready to go to college, on this area of finances again, be careful when you're picking up, selecting what it is you're going to do in life. Be sure that the career that you're going to pick is going to be there, and it commands the kind of salary that if you have to go into debt in order to get the education, that you have the kind of salary to pay the thing off, and to pay it off rather quickly. And for those of you that know what this is like and haven't been there yet, let me tell you that when you get a debt that's $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, or whatever amount it is, apart from the interest, coming up with that amount of money is a very challenging thing for people. And you get out into the workforce, and you've got the baker, the butcher, the candlestick maker, you've got your rent, you've got maybe a car payment, you've got to have a vehicle to get back and forth to work, it becomes very difficult to make those payments. So be careful about even education. Be careful about automobiles. You can end up being tied into something for a long period of time that can give you all kinds of grief. So next frame. Which is it? Is it rock and sand? Rock or sand? Well, in this particular story that I've given you this morning, we're talking about finances, so it's easy to kind of just focus on that one thing. But I want you to look at that in regards to the next frame. See, it's just not finances. It's your marriage. It's the teachings of Jesus regarding children. It's the teachings of Jesus regarding our time and our talent and our treasure and investment in the kingdom of God. It's how we approach our vocation. Is it really there just for us to gain benefits for ourselves, make money, or is there something bigger that you're there for in the office place? It's community. It's having an impact on those that are around us. Every area of your life is supposed to be on the foundation of the words of Christ. And if that's true, then why is it that it is so difficult at times to encourage you to be in the Word of God? That I have to start several weeks ahead and start getting you to evaluate, okay, am I going to be there on Sunday morning to make Sunday school or not? Am I going to put on the back burner going out to dinner with my friends and doing that? When you don't participate in Bible studies, in groups, in Sunday school classes, etc., when you're here late for church, what you're telling me is, I'm okay. I got enough. I'm good. I'm challenging this morning, I really want to look at your feet. No one knows more than you whether or not you are on sand or rock. I think for some of you, what you've got is you've got one foot on rock and another one on sand. Whatever is on sand will not hold up over time. If your finances were wiped out tomorrow, what else is left? For the Christian, that is not an end of life. But as Americans that have been raised with this idea of security and building up assets, retirement, and these kinds of things, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around that. For those of us that have been on Medicaid or some kind of assistance that comes from the federal government, I mean, to think all of a sudden that that might not be there. See, it's a testing, what is your life really built on? What is it all about? Part of the concern here is this idea, what I call Jesus Christ bumper sticker Christianity, is that essentially I'm able to continue to live my life the way I want to live it, and I just paste the sticker of Christ over top of it. You know, I do whatever I want to do regarding my job and my time and my involvement with the community and how I use my words and my language with other people. I just paste a sticker over that. Instead of really examining your life and asking, is this really where God wants me to be? He calls people to be everything from garbage men to teachers to various kinds of instructors to builders, all kinds of things. But are you there really for, is it about you or is it really about Christ? Is it the idea that what I produce is for Him with either my hands or my head? Or is it really just about me? It has to do with your feet. It has to do with an evaluation of really where are my feet grounded. The storms of life are a good thing for the church because they force us to take a look at our feet. They force us to do that. That's why if in our lifetime we do go through the big one, it won't be the worst thing that could ever happen. It could be the best thing. Who knows? We might end up caring for one another in a way that we never thought we'd have to do. So I want you to take this financial word as a word to be forewarned, but I want you to apply it to every sphere of your life. Because He is the God of a rock, and He is more secure than Prudential. But I can't make you stand on the rock. I can tell you about the rock. I can tell you about the liabilities of the sand, but I can't make you do it. Now is the time to use the times that we're in and the uncertainty of it to do an evaluation of your life. Really, what is it all about? Is it about me or is it about God and advancing His kingdom? In Jesus Christ's name, amen.